Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone and J.A. Johnstone's Matt Jensen, The Last Mountain Man. Narrated by Dylan Lynch. With performances by Thomas Penny, Stephen Carpenter, Gary Tells, David Coyne, Johan Detweiler, Michael Glenn, Christopher Graybill, Nanette Savard, Terrence Aselford, Patrick Bussink, Thomas Keegan, Lily David, Michael John Casey, Joel David Santner, Nick DePinto, David Harris, Tracy Oliveira, Elizabeth Jernigan, Eric Messner, and Alyssa Wilmoth. Matt Jensen, The Last Mountain Man, Number 7, Massacre at Powder River.
Grosvenor Square, London, England, June 23, 1944. General Eisenhower followed the secretary through the labyrinthine halls of the residence of the Prime Minister of Britain and past the two pairs of Corinthian columns that led into the cabinet room. Churchill, with the ever-present cigar protruding from his mouth, stood at a small bar pouring whiskey.
Tennessee mash for you, right, General? I prefer Mortlock, which is an excellent single malt scotch.
He handed Eisenhower a glass.
Please, have a seat.
Any word on the buzz bomb attack?
6 killed at the Waterloo Station.
That's a shame.
Better than last weekend, when we lost 200 to the attacks. What's our status with the invasion?
We're advancing toward Cherbourg. I expect we will have it within a few days.
Good, good. That's wonderful news. Oh, by the way, I want to thank you for that pile of Western novels you sent over last week.
I'm glad I had them.
You enjoy reading Western novels, do you?
Yes, sir, I do. I keep a stack of them on my bedside table and probably read about 3 a week.
Outstanding. I'm a fan of the American Western novel as well. Who is your favorite Western author?
I'm fairly eclectic. I like Zane Grey, of course, Owen Wister, Max Brand, and Andy Adams.
Wonderful. I like them as well. Shall we drink to the American West?
It would be an honor.
General Eisenhower held his glass to Churchill's. The men drank. Eisenhower took but a sip, while Churchill took a large swallow.
Tell me, General, have you ever read anything about a Western hero named Matt Jensen?
Yes, of course. In fact, I even know a bit of trivial information about him. His real name wasn't Jensen, it was...
Kavanaugh. Matthew Kavanaugh. But after he was orphaned, he took on the name of his mentor, Smoke Jensen.
Whose real name was Kirby Jensen. And he was quite a hero himself. Tell me, Mr. Prime Minister, how is it that you know so much about Matt Jensen?
I have what you might call a vested interest in that gentleman.
All right, now you have me hooked. Why do you have a vested interest in one of America's Old West heroes?
I have piqued your interest, have I?
I must confess you have.
If it had not been for Matt Jensen, I would not be the Prime Minister of Great Britain, and I would not be sitting here before you discussing the greatest invasion in the history of warfare.
How is that so?
Matt Jensen saved my life.
Livermore, Colorado, late March 1884. When Jarvis Winslow returned home from the city council meeting, he wondered why the house was dark. His wife and daughter should be there, and supper should be on the table.
Julie? Julie, are you here?
Winslow walked over to a nearby table, then lit a lantern. Light filled the room as he turned it up.
Julie?
Hello, Mr. Winslow.
He saw a smallish man with black hair and a large hooked nose. He had a big red spot on his cheek and a gun in his hand.
What? Who are you? Now, what's going on here?
Yeah, who I am doesn't matter. And what's going on is a bank robbery.
A bank robbery? Are you insane? I'm the president of the bank, but I don't keep any money in my house. Wait a minute. I know who you are. You are Red Plummer, aren't you?
Two other men came into the room.
If you know who I am, then you know I'm someone you'd better listen to. let me introduce my associates, Manny Sullivan and Patty McCoy. You don't want to get them angry either.
Where is my wife? Where is my daughter?
Well, they're safe, for the time being. Would you like to see them?
Yes.
Well, they're back in the bedroom. Bring your lantern.
Julie?
Grabbing the lantern, he hurried into the bedroom. When he stepped through the door, he saw his wife and his daughter, both stripped absolutely naked and tied to the bed. They had gags in their mouths and terror in their eyes.
What the hell have you done to them?
We ain't done nothing yet. But I have to tell you, I'm having a hard time keeping Sullivan and McCoy off of them. Now, the only way I'm going to be able to keep them away from your women is if you do exactly what I tell you to do.
What do you want? I'll do it.
I want you to go to the bank, get every dollar the bank has, and bring it here. Once we have the money, we'll be on our way.
I'll get the money. Just don't do anything to hurt my wife and daughter.
I thought we might be able to work something out.
Winslow took one last look at his wife and daughter, then hurried out of the house and over to the bank just one block away. Inside the bank, he emptied the safe, taking out $23,000 and stuffing the money into a bag. He started to leave, but before he did, he scribbled a quick note.
Red Plummer, Manny Sullivan, and Patty McCoy.
When he got back to the house, he hurried to the bedroom.
I got the money. Now let them go.
He looked toward the bed. Their throats had been cut, leaving blood splattered all over the bed. His wife and daughter looked up with glazed, sightless eyes.
You bastards!
Oh, really now, Winslow? You didn't think we were going to let you live after you knew our names, did you?
So shocked by the sight of his wife and daughter, Winslow didn't realize McCoy stood behind him until he felt the knife thrust into his back. One week later, Matt Jensen walked into the Gold Nugget Saloon in Fort Collins, 20 miles south of Livermore. The walls were decorated with game heads and pictures, including one of a reclining nude woman. Three bullet holes strategically placed had augmented the painting, though one shot was slightly off, giving her left breast two nipples. Below the painting hung a mirror which reflected back the long glass shelf of whiskey bottles. At each end of the bar stood a large jar of pickled eggs as well as pickled pig's feet. The saloon also maintained a first-class brothel. Matt saw one of the girls taking a cowboy up the stairs at the back of the room. The upstairs area didn't extend all the way to the front. The main room, or saloon, was big, with exposed rafters below the high peak ceiling. A score or more customers populated the place, sitting at tables or standing at the bar, talking with the girls, drinking or playing cards. Matt was one of those standing at the bar when a woman known as Magnificent Maggie went over to him and put her arm through his. She got her name not from her beauty, but from her size. Weighing over 300 pounds, she was the owner of the Gold Nugget.
Welcome, Mr. Jensen. It's been a while since you've graced us with your presence. What brings you to Fort Collins?
You know me, Maggie. I follow the tumbleweed. You seem to be doing a pretty good business today.
Some days are better than others. Can I get you something to drink, Mr. Jensen?
Yes.
Wine, beer, or whiskey?
Whiskey.
Oh, my. Still alone? You haven't found a girl to keep you company?
Maggie, do you think I could settle for anyone but you?
My, Mr. Jensen, do you have a gift for the blarney? But what would you do if I thought you were serious and took you up on it?
I don't know. I'd do my best, I guess.
Damn, you just made me laugh so hard I peed in my drawers.
Maggie hurried off to take care of the situation, leaving Matt standing alone at the bar, smiling and drinking his whiskey. One of the customers got up and walked over to Matt.
Hello, Matt. It's been a while.
Hello, Bart.
What are you doing in Fort Collins?
Man's got to be somewhere. You still deputy?
No, I'm working as a messenger for Wells Fargo now. It pays me some better. Oh, by the way, I suppose you heard what happened in Livermore last week?
No, what?
Someone killed the bank president and his wife and daughter. There's a paper down at the end of the bar. You can read all about it.
Matt moved down to the end of the counter where a stack of newspapers lay. He put a nickel in the bowl and took one, then found an empty table where he sat down to read. He learned of the gruesome fate of Jarvis Winslow and his wife and daughter. Jarvis Winslow, like Matt Jensen, had been an orphan in the Soda Creek home for wayward boys and girls. They were there at the same time, and a friendship had developed between them. Though they had not maintained steady contact, Matt considered Winslow a brother of sort. He took it personally to learn Jarvis and his family were killed in such a way. Though too late for the funeral, Matt went out to the cemetery where he found three fresh mounds of dirt side by side. There was only one tombstone set in the middle of the three graves.
Jarvis Winslow, his wife Julie, his daughter Cynthia, plucked from this earthly abode by a deed so foul as to defy all understanding.
2 years older than Matt, Jarvis helped him adjust to life in an orphanage. Matt remembered a moment he shared with Jarvis.
You don't have any brothers?
No, I had a sister, but I don't anymore.
I don't have any brothers either. You want to be my brother?
Sure, why not?
Jarvis stuck a pin in the end of his thumb, bringing up a drop of blood. Matt did the same thing, and they held their thumbs together.
Now we are blood brothers, and that is as real brothers.
Jarvis, I don't know if your spirit is still hanging around here or not. I reckon that's a mystery we only find out after we're dead. But in case your spirit is here, and you can hear me, I'm gonna make you this promise. I intend to find the low-life sons of bitches who did this to you and your wife and daughter. I'm gonna send their sorry asses to hell.
Matt left the cemetery, then rode across town to the sheriff's office. When he went inside, he saw Sheriff Garrison and two of his deputies looking at wanted posters.
Matt Jensen, what brings you to Livermore?
The murder of Jarvis Winslow.
Yes, that was a terrible thing. The woman and that girl. I've been in the law business for a long time, and I've seen some grisly things, but I tell you the truth, Matt, that is about the worst I've ever seen. I don't know what kind of animal could do such a thing. They had both been raped. Matt, their throats cut, and they bled to death. Not only that, we found them both naked. Sons of bitches didn't even have the decency to cover them up.
Jarvis Winslow is a personal friend of mine.
No, I'm sorry.
Sheriff, I intend to hunt down the men who did this if you don't mind the help.
Of course, I'm glad to have your help. I can even deputize if you like. That would make it legal as long as you catch up with them in Larimer County. Once they get out of the county, your badge wouldn't do you much good.
It's all right. Got my own badge.
I don't see how that's going to help. This crime had nothing to do with the railroad.
I read in the paper that Plummer, Jenkins, and McCoy got away with $23,000. Is that right?
I'm afraid it is right.
Sheriff, are you going to try and tell me that not one single dollar of that money was ever on a train?
Now that's sort of stretching the intent, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, you'll get no argument from me. Go after him.
Oh, I intend to.
Morton Fruin was an unquenchable optimist, prolific in ideas and skilled in persuading his friends to invest in his schemes. Although he owned the Powder River Cattle Company, his personal field of operations covered America, England, India, Australia, Kenya, and Canada. He had crossed the Atlantic almost 100 times. A brilliant man who urged the building of a canal across the Isthmus of Panama, as well as a means of connecting the Great Lakes to the sea, he was, despite his intellect and creativity, a man who had failed in nearly every business enterprise he undertook. Fruin had the build of an athlete with long legs, a flat abdomen, a high forehead, bright blue eyes, and a Baroque mustache. An avid hunter and sportsman, he attended Cambridge University in England as a gentleman, spending his days betting on horse races and his evenings in the university drinking club. After graduation, he continued the life of a country gentleman, fox hunting and wenching in the shires through the winter, and horse racing and wenching in London during the summer. Living in such a way as to show no interest in a career, he ran through his rather sizable inheritance within 3 years. Shortly thereafter, he came to America, married Clara Jerome, daughter of the very wealthy Leonard Jerome and sister of Lady Randolph Churchill, and set himself up as a rancher in northern Wyoming. Along the Powder River lay a stretch of prairie with grasslands watered by summer rains and winter snows. A large open area, it spread impressive in its very loneliness, but it was good cattle country. And there, Morton Froon built his ranch. Two of the Powder River Cattle Company cowboys, Max Coleman and Lonnie Sneed, rode along the north end of the 20,000-acre spread just south of where Williams Creek branched off the Powder River. They ambled the range, watching over the 1,500 cattle, gathered at a place providing them with shade and water, as they debated about Lily Langtree.
They say she is the most beautiful woman in the world.
Phew, that's a load of bull. I seen pictures of her, and she ain't half as good looking as Mrs. Froon is.
Yeah, well, Miss Froon is the wife of the boss. We can't really talk about her like that.
Oh, hell, I ain't saying nothing about her that everybody else don't say. All I'm talking about is that she's a real good-looking woman. You ain't a-doubting that, are you?
No, I ain't doubting that. But she's the wife of the boss, so I don't think about her like that. But now, Miss Langtree, why, I can think anything about her that I want to, because she's a single woman. And besides which, she goes around the country singing up on the stage. So she's used to people looking at her.
Yeah, but with her, looking's all you can do.
And daydreaming. Sometimes I get to daydreaming about her and I think, well, maybe she's been captured by Injuns or maybe the Yellow Kerchief Gang or someone like that. And I come along and save her.
Sneed, you're fuller of crap than a Christmas goose. if I was you, wait a minute. Look over there, you see that?
Looking in the direction Coleman pointed, Sneed saw someone cutting cattle from the herd.
Well, now, who the hell is that over there? We ain't got anyone out here but us, have we?
No, we ain't got anybody over there. So whoever it is, he must be rustling cows.
Oh, he's got some nerve coming out here all by his lonesome to steal cows.
Maybe he thought there wouldn't be anybody out here.
Dude, shoot. Let's run him off.
The two started riding toward the rustler.
Hey! What you doing here?
Coleman and Sneed continued to ride hard toward the rustler. A single rustler accosted by two armed men should be running, but he wasn't. Coleman began to get an uneasy feeling about it when the rustler stood his ground.
Sneed, hold up. There's something ain't right about this.
Suddenly, Coleman and Sneed saw why the rustler they were advancing toward was so brazen. He wasn't alone. At least six others wore a patch of yellow at their necks.
Damn! It's a Yellow Kerchief Gang!
Let's get the hell out of here!
The two cowboys wheeled their horses about, and the hunters became the hunted. The seven outlaws started after them. The two men galloped away, pursued by the rustlers. Hitting Williams Creek in full stride, sand and silver bubbles flew up in a sheet of spray sustained by the churning action of the horses' hooves until large drops began falling back like rain. Coleman pointed to an island in the middle of the stream.
Sneed! They're gonna run us down! Let's just try to make a stand there! It's our only chance!
The two cowboys brought their steeds to a halt. Dismounting, they took what shelter they could find behind the large rock that dominated the island. The rustlers held up at the edge of the creek.
How many bullets you got?
Four.
Just four? You got any in your belt?
No, just these four is all I got. How many you got?
Five.
That ain't very many.
I mean, it'll have to do.
Son of a bitch, here they come.
At first, Coleman and Sneed entertained to hope the rustlers, who had missed so far, would become frustrated and ride away, leaving them unharmed. Then, three more men wearing yellow scarves rode up to join the other seven. A furious gunfight broke out between the rustlers and the cowboys, but the rustlers expended bullets at a ratio of 20-1 over the two cowboys. The odds, not only in terms of men, but of available bullets, were just too great. Within a matter of minutes, and with two cowboys dead, the rustlers returned to their task of stealing cattle. At a small cabin located at the head of a long, deep ravine carved into a butte at the end of Nine Mile Creek, the 10 men who killed Coleman and Sneed and stole the cattle celebrated their success. The men ranged in age from 21 to 45 years old. Every one of them carried a record from burglary to murder. They had been operating in Johnson County for the last 6 months, quite successfully rustling cattle, turning into, by far, their biggest job yet.
Well, I make it at least 1,000 head. Maybe more.
Good idea, Poindexter. Hey, Logan, think maybe we could cut a butcher one, have us some fresh beef?
Clayton missed the raid with the others. He was a good enough cook, the rest of the men didn't mind that he never joined them on any raids.
All right, I guess we got enough this time that we ain't gonna miss one cow.
The Yellow Kerchief Gang followed the lead of Sam Logan. He started his outlaw career in New Mexico riding with two desperados, Kid Barton and Coal Oil Johnny. Johnny may have had a last name, but if so, nobody ever learned it. The three men terrorized anyone who happened on the Santa Fe Trail, whether stagecoach, freight wagon, or a single rider on horseback. If they attacked a stagecoach or freight wagon, all three of them would participate. If it was a single horseman, then only one would approach, slowly, quietly, and without giving any hint of danger. He would ride alongside their mark for a few minutes, carrying on a friendly conversation, then turn to him and suddenly shoot him dead. Kid Barton and Coal Oil Johnny were the most notorious of the group. They tended to revel in their notoriety, whereas Sam Logan purposely kept a low profile. As rewards got posted, the offers for Kid Barton and Coal Oil Johnny grew, with no reward at all for Sam Logan. Kid Barton and Coal Oil Johnny sometimes took great delight in teasing him for not being worth anything, while the reward on each of them reached $1,000. Logan, who had not established a name, killed them both as they were waiting beside the road to hold up a stagecoach. When the coach arrived, Logan waved it down and pointed to the two men, claiming he had overheard them plotting to rob the coach. He not only got the bounty money, a total of $2,000, he also became a hero for stopping a robbery. He used that publicity to get himself hired as city marshal for the town of Salcedo. Logan's stint as a lawman didn't work out very well for him. When he killed a personal envoy from Governor Lew Wallace, he wound up in his own jail. Tried and convicted for murder, Logan was sentenced to hang. But on the night before the execution, Logan killed the deputy acting as city marshal, a deputy he had personally hired and befriended and broke jail. He left New Mexico and went north, all the way to Wyoming, where he organized a group of cutthroats and thieves into the Yellow Kerchief Gang. He resumed his earlier career of robbery, entering a new phase when he started rustling cattle. Sussex, Wyoming, early April 1884. And the cemetery lay under a field of white, interrupted by grave markers, both crosses and tombstones. The cemetery was crowded with people as they lay Max Coleman and Lonnie Sneed to rest. It wasn't just the cowboys from the Powder River Cattle Company, but from nearly all the other ranches in Johnson County. They all stood bundled up in mackinaws, parkas, and sheepskin coats, their breath making little vapor clouds in the air, holding their hats in their hands while the parson intoned the last words of committal. As the mourners began to leave the cemetery, their departure marked by exiting horses, wagons, surreys, buckboards, and carriages, William Teasdale trudged through the snow to come over and speak with Fruin. Well-dressed, he stood a portly man of about 50. Red-faced and breathing hard, Sir William Teasdale, Lord of Denby, like Morton Fruin, was an Englishman, part of the influx of wealthy Brits who had come to America to invest in and run cattle ranches. Teasdale's ranch, Thistledown, was adjacent to the Powder River Cattle Company.
When your two men were killed, how many cattle did you lose?
What? Oh, I don't know exactly, but I'm sure it was over 1,000 head.
I've heard that it was at least 1,500 head.
It may have been. I'm not sure.
You're not sure?
No, not exactly.
Morton, you do have investors in your ranch, don't you? Important men back in England?
Yes, of course.
Don't you think you owe it to them to be able to render accurate reports as to just how many cattle were rustled?
I suppose I do. But to be honest with you, William, when I learned of the death of two of my cowboys, that sort of pushed everything else out of my mind.
Yes, well, of course, it is a shame that they were killed. But you have investors back in England that you must answer to. You can't pass that off by saying you are more concerned with the fact that you lost a couple of mere cowboys. Let's face it, Morton, the bottom line for both of us is business. Cattle business. And the rate of our losses now has just about made our business unsustainable. This cattle rustling is beginning to get out of hand.
I agree, but I don't have any idea what to do about it.
I must get going. My offer still stands.
Morton climbed into the back seat of his carriage with his wife.
What offer is that?
He wants to buy our ranch.
Has he made a decent offer?
Yes, unless you count all the cattle, the house and buildings, and all the horses and equipment. Then his offer is less than one quarter of what the place is worth.
Why would he offer you so little? Does he really expect you to take it?
He knows that some of my investors are getting worried, and he's gambling that I'm ready to pull out of the venture altogether.
Manny Sullivan lay on top of a flat rock, looking back along the trail over which they had just come. The rider was still following them.
Is the son of a bitch still there?
Yeah. We done everything we could to shake that son of a bitch, but he's clung to us like a sand spur. I believe he could track a bird through the air.
They say that Matt Jensen is that good.
You sure now that it is Matt Jensen?
Yeah, I'm sure. Like I told you, I heard that Matt Jensen was asking questions about us.
Damn, that's not good. That's not good at all. You think he knows about the robbing and killing we done back in Livermore?
Of course he knows. Why else would he be coming after us?
I don't know. I'm just wondering why he's taking such a personal interest in us, and I'm also wondering how the hell he found out we're the ones that done it.
How he found out don't matter now. What does matter is how we're going to get shed of the son of a bitch. We're going to have to do that, or we ain't never going to have any peace.
How are we going to get rid of him? We done everything we could, and we still can't shake him off.
We ain't going to shake him off.
If we don't shake him off, what are we going to do with him?
We're going to kill him!
McCoy pointed to a coulee ahead.
Let's go up there.
Ain't you ever been up here before? That's a dead-end canyon.
I know it's a dead-end canyon. One of the reasons I come this way is because I know this canyon real good, and I know it has a cave about halfway up the wall on the left side. And not only that, there is a bunch of rocks around the mouth of the cave, so that if a feller don't know it's there, it ain't likely that he will ever even see it. I figure we can hide in the cave till he passes underneath, then we'll shoot the son of a bitch in the back. All we have to do is let him follow us in.
What if he don't come in?
He'll come in, all right. He wants us pretty bad, else he wouldn't be dogging us so hard.
The two men rode on into the canyon, ground-tied their horses around a bend and out of sight, then climbed up the wall to the cave.
What did I tell you? Get ready. He'll be coming by directly, and when he does, we'll let him have it. He won't even know what hit him.
We should have gone on up to Cheyenne with Plummer. If we had, we wouldn't be in this mess now.
There is a reason why we didn't go into Cheyenne, remember? We killed that deputy up there last year, and there's just too many people who knows us.
I guess that's right. Still, it don't seem right that Red Plummer's got away scot-free and we're the ones being hounded. Especially since it was all Plummer's idea in the first place.
Yeah, well, it ain't all that bad. Once we get rid of Jensen, we'll get as far away from here as we can. And don't forget, we got us enough money that we can start over somewhere else, maybe down in Texas.
Matt had been in this same canyon less than a year earlier, and he knew it was a dead end. But the two men he was chasing had gone into it, and that left Matt asking the question, did they not know it was a dead end? Or did they know, and they were just trying to draw him in to set up an ambush? Didn't matter. They might think they were setting up an ambush, but as far as Matt was concerned, they had just ridden into a trap. He rode all the way up to the mouth of the canyon, but instead of riding in, he dismounted and pulled his long gun out of the saddle holster.
You going in, Spirit?
But when you hear gunfire, you run like hell, you hear me?
Spirit started on into the canyon. Spirit galloped through, the bullets whizzing harmlessly over the empty saddle. Matt saw a wisp of smoke drifting up from halfway up the wolf's side, and he smiled, because he knew exactly where they were. There was a cave there, a cave that Matt had personally explored. As he started toward the area where he knew the cave was, he saw someone rise up to take a look.
What the hell? There wasn't nobody on that horse, was there?
As Matt studied the area where the two men had positioned themselves, he smiled. He not only knew about the cave, he knew what the men who had taken shelter there might not know. He knew that the cave had another entrance. Matt fired toward where he knew the mouth of the cave was. Matt knew that he didn't have a clean shot from here, but that wasn't why he was shooting. He was shooting to drive them back into the cave and to let them know that he knew where they were.
You boys seem to have gotten yourselves into a little trap, haven't you? As long as you're in that cave, all I have to do is wait here until you decide to come out.
What do you want? What are you chasing us for?
That was my brother and his family that you killed back in Livermore.
You're chasing the wrong people. We didn't do that. What makes you think we did it?
Jarvis Winslow told us it was you.
What? That's impossible. That son of a bitch was dead when we left him.
Sullivan, you dumbass. You just confessed.
Don't. Anyhow, I know he didn't tell you.
He didn't exactly tell us. He left us a note in the bank.
God, I knew somebody should have went with him.
Why don't you two come on down with your hands up? You know damn well that I've got you trapped there. The only way you can go is to come down, and unless you come down without your weapons, I'll shoot you as soon as you poke your head out.
There was no response from the two men, so Matt waited for a few seconds. Then he fired again.
No need for me to be wasting any more ammunition. I'll just wait here until you come out.
Well, you can just wait until hell freezes over, because we ain't about to give up to you.
Oh, I don't think I'll have to wait until hell freezes over. But I'm willing to wait here as long as it takes.
Now that Matt had them believing that he was going to stay down there, he moved quickly to a part of the mountain that they couldn't see from the cave. It wasn't an easy climb up, but it wasn't impossible. And within half an hour, Matt was on top, standing over the hole that ran chimney-like down into the cave. Matt climbed down the shaft, which was about 75 feet long, but at enough of an angle that it was easier to negotiate than had been the climb up. When he dropped down into the cave, he was about 200 yards behind the men. Behind him was all dark, so he could walk almost all the way up to them without being seen. On the other hand, the two men he had been chasing were standing in the mouth of the cave, easily visible because they were backlit by the bright light from outside.
How about you two boys tossing your guns this way?
Oh, what the hell?
McCoy and Sullivan both fired. Matt returned fire. With his gun in hand, Matt approached the two men cautiously. Sullivan had been killed outright, but he saw that McCoy was still breathing.
I'm dying, ain't I?
Yeah, you are.
I'm dying and you're just standing there watching.
Not much else I can do. Look at it this way. Getting shot beats getting your neck stretched with a rope.
Yeah, that's right, ain't it? You still looking for Plummer? Or have you already found him?
I'm still looking for him.
You'll find him in Cheyenne. He's the son of a bitch that got us into this. If I'm going down, I want him to go down too.
I appreciate the information.
Are you just going to stand there and watch me die? Aren't you even going to try and patch me up?
There's nothing I can do for you.
Oh, you son of a bitch. You are enjoying it, aren't you? You are enjoying watching me die?
Yeah, I am.
After McCoy died, Matt looked through their saddlebags. He found a little over $6,000 in each bag. The next day, Matt rode into Livermore with the two bodies draped over their horses, stopping in front of the sheriff's office. He was met by Sheriff Garrison and a couple of his deputies.
Who did you get?
Sullivan and McCoy.
Matt opened his saddlebag.
And I've recovered $12,000 that was taken from the bank. Before McCoy died, he told me the plumber had gone to Cheyenne.
I'll wire the sheriff there.
You can wire him if you want to, but I'm personally going after him. I'll send what money I find on him back to the bank here.
You're a good man, Matt.
Powder River Cattle Company Ranch, Taney Creek, first week of May, 1884. Paul Graham, Phil Bates, Emmett Carroll, and Cooter Miles were in the Taney Creek line shack. They had come up 2 weeks ago to make preparations for the spring roundup.
What do you mean? Are you trying to tell me you never had a woman, Emmett?
I'm only 16. I ain't never really had the chance to do it. I wouldn't even know how to go about getting a woman interested in me.
Well, hell, there ain't nothing to it. All you got to do is go to a whorehouse. If you got the money, whores don't care how old you are.
I don't know about that, Bates. Mama said she didn't want me seeing any whores.
Where's your mama now?
She's down in Denver.
Then what your mama don't know won't hurt her none, will it?
Tell you what, boys. How about the next time we all go into town together, we get this boy broke in? We'll chip in and buy him a whore.
Buy him a whore? Hell, most of the time I don't have enough money for my own whore. Why should I pay for the boy?
Because we got to get him broke in good. And I figure the best one to handle that would be Cavalry Mona.
Ha ha! Yeah, Cavalry Mona. Now, I would be willing to help pay for that.
Why do they call her Cavalry Mona?
They call her that because near about everyone in the United States cavalry has rode her at least once.
I don't know. Is she pretty?
Is she pretty, you ask? Hell, boy, you don't go with whores because they're pretty. You go with them because they are there.
What do you say, Emmett? You about ready to become a man?
I think I better go down to the creek and get us some water.
You know what I think? I think our Emmett ain't all that fired up about bedding Cavalry Mona.
Who knows? I'm thinking maybe we'll be able to talk him into it.
Whose time is to cook breakfast?
It's your time.
Oh. Well, then, I better get started.
I'll give you a hand.
The two men started putting together what they would need for breakfast. Bates got out the flour and lard for biscuits. Graham started carving off pieces of bacon.
I wonder what the hell is keeping Emmett with the water. Maybe I better go take a look.
Now hurry back. I ain't got enough water to roll out the biscuits with.
Graham got out his book and started writing.
You always writing in that book of yourn. What is it you're writing anyhow? You writing a story or something? You going to publish a book and become famous? Cooking on the range with Two-Gun Pete.
Now, I'm not writing a book. I'm just taking notes is all.
Bates walked over to the window and looked outside.
That's funny.
What?
Well, there ain't neither one of them come back yet. And I don't see either one of them down to the creek.
Graham walked over to look as well.
Maybe I better go see what's keeping them.
I'm not sure that's such a good idea.
What do you mean?
I don't like the looks of this. I think there might be some out there keeping them coming back.
Damn! It's the Yeller Kerchief Rustlers!
Bates, you better get down!
Oh, I've been shot! Oh, Graham! I've been shot!
Bates went down and Graham went over to check on him. Bates had been hit in the stomach and in the side.
Bates! Bates?
Oh.
No, I think you're better off if you don't move. Wait, I'll see what I can do about stopping the bleeding.
Staying low on the floor, Graham crawled over to the bunk and pulled off a blanket. Returning to Bates, he tore the blanket into a couple of strips and wrapped them around Bates, covering the wounds.
Oh, thanks.
Graham raced up to look outside, and he could see a few people moving around. Took a couple of shots at them, but didn't hit anyone. He took another look at Bates. Bates' eyes were closed. Graham moved over to another part of the cabin and began writing.
Me and Bates was fixing breakfast when the attack come. Emmett had already went down to the creek after water. When he did not come back, Cooter went to see what the matter was, and he didn't come back neither. Bates started to go see what was keeping the two of them, but I told him I think there might be someone out there that wasn't letting the other two come back. Then suddenly shooting started, and Bates looked out the window and said, "Damn, it's the Yeller Kerchief Rustlers." And Bates got shot, but he didn't get killed yet.
Over the next 2 hours, the shooting continued heavier sometimes than other, but never so light as to give Graham the idea that if he tried to leave, he could make it. But he wouldn't leave anyway. Not with Bates too badly hurt to leave with him.
Bates? Bates, how you doing?
I ain't doing all that well.
Don't you be dying on me now, Pard, you hear me? I don't want to be left all alone here.
You reckon Emmett and Cooter's dead already?
I reckon so.
I'm going to die too, ain't I?
Pard, I reckon both of us going to die.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, at least me and you had us a woman. Emmett never had him one at all. Wish we could have got him to town and done what we was going to do.
Bates grew quiet after that, and Graham went back to his writing.
It is now about 2 hours since the first shot. Bates is still alive, but he's in awful bad shape. They're still shooting and all around the house. Boys, there are bullets coming in like hail. Them fellas is all hid behind the rocks and such so good I can't get at them. They're shooting from the creek and from the back of the house. Bates, I know you're bad hit, but if you could look out the back and just tell me if they're coming. It's kind of hard trying to hold them off all alone like this. Bates.
Graham went over and put his ear on Bates' chest to listen for a heartbeat, but he got none.
You sons of bitches!
Graham raised up and fired several rounds, but they were fired in frustration only. He knew he didn't hit anything, nor could he. Then he saw them pull up a wagon and start loading it with brush and weed. That didn't look good to him. He sat back down and started riding again.
Bates is dead. He died about 9 o'clock. Now I can see him loading brush and wood and such into a wagon. And I got the tongue drawed up and the wagon is pointed toward the shack. I think maybe they might be fixing to set fire to the wagon and push it downhill toward the line shack. I don't think they intend to let me get away.
For the time being, the shooting had stopped. Raising up, Graham could see them quite clearly now. He thought he recognized one of them.
I see 12 or 15 men. One looks like Sam Logan. I don't know if it is or not. If I had me a pair of glasses, I might know some of these men. I gotta look out. Well, they just got through shelling the house again like hail. And they got the fire going good on the wagon, and they're fixing to push it down on me. Time for me to go. Goodbye, boys, if I don't ever see you again.
The wagon came rolling down toward the line shack, hopped up over the low front porch, then crashed into the side. Within moments, the line shack was on fire, and though there were no flames inside yet, the smoke was so thick that Graham could scarcely breathe. Graham picked up Bates' pistol so that he had two guns. He cocked both pistols, then kicked the door open and dashed outside, firing both pistols. There's very little smoke outside, most of it being whipped in through the little cabin by the wind. As a result, Graham found himself standing in the open, looking at a ring of men, all wearing yellow kerchiefs. He opened fire. So did the rustlers. He felt the first two bullets plunge into his body. The third hit him in the forehead, ending his life. Froon was in the study of his house reading a letter from London when Clara came into the study.
Clara, guess what? Your sister Jenny is coming to visit you.
Oh, what wonderful news that is.
I wonder how she will take to the Wild West.
I'm sure she will get along splendidly. After all, we are Americans, you know.
Yes, I know, dear. But neither you nor Lady Churchill were exactly raised in a log cabin.
I may not have been raised in one, but I'm living in one now.
You call this a log cabin? You have hurt my feelings.
This is a wonderful log cabin, and I love it. Does Jenny say in the letter that she will be bringing her child?
Yes, the little brat will be with her.
He is not a little brat. Winnie is a wonderful child and smart as a whip. Why, with his intelligence, background, and upbringing, I predict he will do great things one day.
Ha! Winston Churchill doing great things? That will be the day.
There was a knock at the door to the study, and looking toward it, Froon saw his gentleman's gentleman.
Yes, Benjamin?
My lord, Mr. Morrison would have a word with you.
Myron Morrison, foreman of the Powder River Cattle Company, was a big man with gray hair and beard. Enlisting in the Union Army as a private, he was a major when the war ended, and with no family and no place to call home, he'd come west. After a few adventures, as Morrison called them, he was never specific about his adventures, and Froon had never asked, he began working as a cowboy, and now was the foreman of one of the biggest ranches in Wyoming.
Then by all means, show him in.
Froon had a smile on his face as he stood to greet his foreman, but when Morrison came in, he had a grim expression on his face.
Mr. Morrison, what is it?
I have some bad news for you, Mr. Froon. This morning, Ralph Turner rode out to the Tanta Creek Line Shack to take fresh provisions to the men there. He found the shack burned and all four men dead.
What? You mean they couldn't escape the fire?
No, sir, it isn't that. There was a burned-out wagon up against the burned-out shack. Looks like it was purposely set afire. There was only one body inside, and it was too badly burned to identify, but we found Graham, Emmett, and Cooter outside, all shot. So we're sure the body inside was that of Phil Bates, seeing as he was with them.
Oh, those poor men. None of them were married, were they?
No, sir.
Thank God for that, at least.
Yes, sir. It's bad enough that they all have parents, but it'd be doubly worse if they had wives and children. And, of course, Emmett wasn't much more than a child himself. He was only 15 or 16.
It was the Yellow Kerchief Gang, wasn't it? They were the ones who killed Coleman and Sneed a couple of weeks ago, and they left a yellow flag on a post to brag about it, the bloody bastards. I don't suppose they left a yellow flag this time, did they?
No, sir.
Well, no matter. I'm sure it was them. There's no way of telling for certain, of course, but I've no doubt but that they also did this.
There was no yellow flag, but we know for a fact that Graham, Emmett, Cooter, and Bates were killed by the Yellow Kerchief Bunch.
Oh? How do we know?
I know you're going to find this hard to believe, Mr. Froon, but you might recall that the other boys were always teasing Graham about keeping notes on everything that was happening. They all wanted to know if he was writing a book. Well, sir, he had that little tally book with him, and he wrote it all down. Everything that happened. They found this lying under him.
Morrison handed a small notebook to Froon.
Read this.
Froon took the notebook, then pulled his finger back quickly. There was a small spot of blood on his index finger.
Sorry about that. I thought I got all the blood cleaned away.
It's all right.
Froon walked back to the chair and sat down to read. After Froon finished reading the journal, he bowed his head and pinched the bridge of his nose. He was quiet for a long time. Claire had left the room when Morrison came in. Now she returned.
Mr. Morrison, would you like a cup of coffee?
No, ma'am. Thank you.
Morton. Morton, what is it? What is wrong?
Froon handed the notebook to her.
Paul Graham, Phil Bates, Emmett Carroll, and Cooter Miles. All killed. Graham left an account.
He left an account?
Yes, ma'am. You'll find it all written down there in his tally book.
Clara found a chair and settled down to read Graham's account.
Four at the line shack, and two on the island in Williams Creek. That makes six good men that we have had killed by the Yellow Kerchief Gang.
After that, Froon and Morrison remained silent until Clara finished reading Bates's journal.
Oh, I can hardly stand to read this. How terrible it must have been for him.
Mr. Froon, do you have any idea why they might be specifically targeting you?
Targeting me? What do you mean, targeting me? They are hitting all the ranches in the county, aren't they?
Well, they are hitting other ranchers, yes, sir, but I've been talking to some of the other foremen, and none of the other ranchers have been hit near as badly as we have. Like you said, we've lost six good men. There's only been two other cowboys killed in this entire county. And all the other ranchers combined haven't lost as many cattle as we've lost.
I didn't know that. I don't know why we should be the ones suffering the most. And I don't have any idea of what to do about it.
Would you like a suggestion?
Marshal Drew spoke to Froon when he went into town to show him the journal. Marshal Drew was not only the city marshal of Sussex, he was also a deputy sheriff, thus giving him some authority beyond the city limits.
If you have an idea, yes, I would love a suggestion.
You ever heard of a man named Matt Jensen?
Matt Jensen? No, I can't say that I have. Who is he?
Well, I never met him either, you understand, but I have read about him, and I heard a lot about him. Now, he's a lone wolf kind of man who wanders around a lot. From what I hear, he's the kind of man who puts things right.
What do you mean by put things right?
Well, sir, he's a gunman, Mr. Froon.
A gunman? My word. Marshal, are you, a lawman, actually suggesting that I hire a gunman?
Yes, sir, I am. I think what's happening here now is just the sort of thing where a gunman might be handy to have.
Do you really think I should resort to something like this?
I'm gonna be honest with you, Mr. Fruin. As a deputy, my jurisdiction outside of town is limited. But even so, I wouldn't be able to handle this situation. And there's no way Sheriff Canton can handle it either.
He certainly hasn't been able to handle it yet, has he?
No, sir, he has not.
All right. Let's suppose I did want to hire this gunman of yours, this Matt Jensen. Do you have any idea how I can get in touch with him?
Not normally. I wouldn't have the slightest idea how to locate him. But Mr. Murphy said he saw him at the Cheyenne Club in Cheyenne last week. Now, I don't know if he's still in Cheyenne, but if he is, more than likely we could send a letter to him. Care of the Cheyenne Club, and it'd get to him.
Good idea. All right, I will write him a letter.
Now, you better make sure it's a good letter so you can get his attention. A man like Matt Jensen probably gets a dozen or so requests for help a week.
Don't worry, Marshal. I will find a way to get his attention.
The Boar's Head Saloon was on 18th Street, just across from the Western Hotel. It was one of the many saloons along Cheyenne's 18th Street that appealed to the lowest caliber customer. Matt was looking for Red Plummer, and he knew that the Boar's Head was exactly the kind of saloon Red Plummer would frequent. Red Plummer was a thin man with dark, unruly hair, a nose like a hawk's beak, and a large red birthmark on his face. He was also missing the lower lobe of his left ear, having had it bitten off during a fight while he was in prison. Matt didn't want to make a scene here in the bar, deciding it would be better to just wait Plummer out until he left the saloon. Then Matt would confront him on the street. The question was, had Plummer recognized him? Matt had just turned back toward the bar when suddenly a knife flashed by beside him. The blade buried itself about an inch into the bar. Drawing his pistol and turning toward the direction from which the knife had come, he saw Plummer getting up from a table with a gun in his hand. Plummer fired just as Matt instinctively moved to his left. Matt returned fire. Matt stood there, holding the smoking pistol in his hand as he looked at Plummer to see if the outlaw represented any further danger. For a long moment, there was absolute quiet in the saloon, as everyone had been shocked into silence by the sudden and unexpected gunplay. Finally, one brave soul wandered over to look down at Plummer. There was a dark red hole in Plummer's shirt, just over his heart. His right hand was still clutching the grip of his pistol, and his eyes were open and staring sightlessly toward the ceiling. Matt looked through Plummer's saddlebags, then pulled out a little sack. Reaching down into the sack, he withdrew a thick packet of greenbacks. Half an hour later, with the money duly counted and secured with the sheriff, and with the receipt in his hand for $9,276, Matt's task was completed, except for the shooting inquiry that the municipal court had scheduled for 10 o'clock the next morning. After the inquiry, Matt would have no reason to hang around Cheyenne any longer. It was too late in the day to leave now, so he was going to have to spend at least one more night here. He had been staying at the Western Hotel because of its convenience to all the saloons on 18th Street, and he saw no reason to move out just for one more night. But he decided that he would like to have a good dinner for this last night, so leaving everything at the Western, he walked down to the Cheyenne Club.
Mr. Jensen, a letter came for you today.
Matt looked at the manager curiously.
A letter from me? And was delivered here? That's strange.
Yes, sir, I thought so as well. I wasn't sure you were in town, so I was going to send it back tomorrow. But if you will wait here for just a moment, I'll get it for you.
Matt waited until the manager returned, holding the letter in his hand.
It is from Mr. Morton Fruin. Do you know him?
No, I don't.
He's one of the high-toned Brits, you know, a lord or a sir or something like that. I never can keep it straight. He's also a member of our club. It could be that he saw you one of the times you were here and just decided this would be the best place to reach you.
Could be, but I have no idea why he would want to get in touch with me.
Matt walked into the big, spacious parlor room, exchanging greeting nods with some of the other members. Then he settled into one of the oversized leather chairs.
My dear Mr. Jensen, your name has been put forth to me by loyal and true friends as someone who can help me deal with a crisis that is striking not only my ranch, but many ranches here in Johnson County, Wyoming. There is a group of rustlers working the ranges here, stealing cattle with ruthless impunity. Led by a man named Sam Logan, they are organized as well as any military unit, and they identify themselves by wearing a yellow kerchief at their throat and a yellow band around their hat. It is this appurtenance to their apparel that provides the sobriquet, the Yellow Kerchief, by which these scoundrels are known. Although I am losing cattle at a rate that is unsustainable, it isn't just the loss of cattle that has me concerned. In the last month, I have had 6 of my men murdered by this gang. I and some of my neighbors have approached the local constabularies in a plea that something be done, but the problem is clearly bigger than anything the law can handle. It is my hope that the enclosed draft will be sufficient to hire you to investigate the cause of my cattle loss, and if possible, to put a stop to it, and to bring justice to these murderers. Sincerely, Morton Fruin.
Matt looked back into the envelope and saw a second piece of paper. When he removed the paper, he saw that it was, indeed, a bank draft drawn on the Stock Growers National Bank in Cheyenne. When he looked at the amount the draft was for, he blinked in surprise. It was for $5,000.